This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
So, last week we started looking at the actual like prayer and its mechanics, and we went through the obligatory parts to it. I know there's some new people here this week. There's people who are typically here who aren't here with us. So if it's your first time here, we've been recording all the classes. You can find them on our YouTube channel. You can listen to things on our podcasts. I'm also happy to meet with people one-on-one just to kind of get you up to speed. But the idea of us doing this is to take a deep dive into what is a foundational element of ritual in Islam, the prayer. Meaning the daily prayers, and to present it in a way for those who are new to Islam. They might have been born into a Muslim family, but they're rebuilding their relationship with their faith, they're converts, they're exploring Islam, that allows for the mode of engagement to be one that understands kind of where you're at in this phase of your life, and doesn't necessarily become overwhelming in a way that it doesn't have to be, but it's presented in a way that shows there's kind of a systematic approach, so you don't have to overnight suddenly like learn Arabic, for example, or suddenly know the meaning of all these different things, or have things literally get lost in translation that makes it feel very kind of disconnected and foreign. Does that make sense? And so already what we've done, just to get people up to speed, we took a deep dive into the first chapter of the Quran. It's called Surah Fatiha, means the opening. And it's a chapter that's recited in every unit of prayer. It wasn't just a translation, but to kind of distill, like, well, what's the meaning behind this, right? Because you could even know the translation of something, but it doesn't mean that the words necessarily resonate so well. In the coming weeks, we're going to look at two shorter chapters of the Quran. And kind of go into those in a little bit more detail. Also, that as you're learning and memorizing things, you're able to kind of understand a little bit more of what you're talking about. And that's kind of the idea, right? In building focus and concentration. And the example we used at that time was, say I was standing here speaking a language that no one could speak in the room, you know? Let's say, theoretically, no one in the room could speak Chinese. I don't know if anyone can speak Chinese in the room. Can any of you speak Chinese? Yeah. Great. So if I was standing here speaking Chinese, or I just pretended like I could, and you had no idea, because I don't know how to speak Chinese, but neither do you, so I could be making up whatever I want to, you fundamentally wouldn't be able to build deep concentration, not for any other reason other than there's just a language barrier. So how would you be able to retain and absorb when the literal meaning of the words is something that is beyond our capacity to engage, do you know? Let alone then just how overwhelming it can feel trying to memorize or regurgitate something as you're simultaneously kind of doing everything else that you're doing. It's not in a vacuum. Does that make sense? So today what we're going to be looking at is a second bucket of what goes into the mechanics of the prayer. Salaam alaikum. You come in and take a seat. So last week, what we talked about were the obligatory aspects, what are called the fard aspects of the prayer. These are things that if they're not present, like the prayer doesn't count in and of itself. Not the conditions outside of the prayer, but what goes into the mechanics of the prayer and what it is that one needs at a minimum once you are in the prayer itself. Does anybody remember or want to kind of walk us through some of what those were? The integrals of the prayer for those who were here last week. Yeah.
Standing.
Yeah, so standing in the prayer is the second integral of the prayer, like the literal standing posture in the prayer. Yeah. What was before this?
Intention.
Intention. Niyyah.
So the intention was one of the conditions outside of the prayer, right? So you've made the intention. What do you do next? The wudu is also a condition outside of the prayer. Yeah. So I made the intention. How do I enter into the prayer? It's okay.
Say Allahu Akbar.
Yeah, so you say Allahu Akbar, right? Some people can say it's something to glorify God. This is like the integrals of the prayer, right? It might not be what one might be accustomed to seeing. It's called the tahrima. So you're essentially saying what is that initial Allahu Akbar. And this like puts you in the state of prayer. What's next in terms of like the obligations of prayer? It's okay if people don't remember. They weren't here last time. You can also look at notes you took. So when you're standing, like, what do you normally do in the standing if you've ever seen a Muslim person pray?
Actually recite the prayer.
Yeah, so you're going to recite, right? And in the obligations, all you have to recite is any, like, short verse of the Quran. The shortest verse in the Quran is two words. It says, ثُمَّ نَذِرْ, then he looked. So if you recite just that, you meet the obligatory part of the prayer. That's all you have to say, right? This is in the obligations. It's not what the end product will look like as we're going through this, but the bare minimum, which if you have a reason as to why you would do that, which if you're new to Islam or you're new to the ritual prayer in Islam, there's not going to be an expectation that you have memorized everything right off the bat. Does that make sense? Yeah? What was after this? What usually comes next if you see a Muslim person pray from the standing? What do they do? So they're going to do the bowing, which is called ruku. And then? Yeah, and then you have a prostration. And then the last piece.
Awesome.
Yeah. You're going to do a final sitting. So this is what is obligatory in a prayer. The only part where you have to say something is in this section, reciting any short verse of the Quran. When you talk to somebody who is Muslim, they might tell you what is the last kind of element of it. You got to memorize this chapter and say all these verses. And when you're bowing, you have to say this. And when you're prostrating, you have to say this. And it can become very overwhelming. The idea is that as you are doing this in the window of time, you are at a reasonable pace learning what are the other elements. These are the obligatory parts. So if this doesn't happen in the course of the prayer, then the prayer doesn't count. The next section that we're going to talk about now are going to be what's called the necessary or wajib parts to the prayer. So the relationship between this and this is essentially like the skeleton of the prayer. And this column is going to be what adds like kind of flesh to the prayer. And then next week, what we're going to discuss is going to be what are the recommended practices or what are called sunnah. And this is what will add kind of ornamental like beauty to the prayer. Does that make sense? So you conceptualize this as your physical body. Like, Here is the innermost part of you, that skeleton. Building upon it now are these necessary actions. And here is then what is that kind of final phase of the prayer itself. What most people get and what most people give right from the onset is this bucket right here. And it becomes really overwhelming, as you'll see as we build this list out. It's going to go from just these six things to a lot more stuff that says, here, figure all of this out. And you don't want to do that in a way that is either overwhelming the person you're trying to teach or also kind of overwhelming yourself if you're trying to figure it out. Do you know what I mean? Because the postures here and the mechanics to this make it very simple as you're learning these other boxes, right? And you can do this in a way that also creates an ease as you're getting acclimated to like the schedule of things. You know, somebody has not prayed five times a day in their life ever. Somebody has never woken up at sunrise before, let alone tries to figure out now, like as they've woken up, like how do I do this in a way that also I am not dealing with dejection because I don't know these words. I don't know if I'm doing every single thing right, right? But the notion is such that in Islam, like God knows his creation better than his creation knows itself. And so there's going to be a pedagogy to like teaching that isn't just simply enough to say that because a Muslim person prays, they know how to teach us how to pray, you know? And someone might just give you what they have in the first place, but if they're giving you this last bucket as a first step, it can create like a lot of stress. Do you get what I mean? So this is where you want to see, like for somebody who's new to it, somebody's building a relationship, it becomes a reason as to why they would do this. And we're working our way towards this box, which we're gonna talk about this one next week. And we're gonna go through this section today. Does that make sense? Okay. So where you have now in the necessary acts, I'm gonna use a different color marker. You're going to have and you want to kind of compare these two. So of the necessary acts, the first one is going to be actually saying the words Allahu Akbar. Whereas here, you could say something that's just glorifying God in some capacity, right? But here now, the actual words of saying Allahu Akbar at the initiation of the prayer, when you're beginning the prayer in the tahrima, as opposed to some other form of kind of remembrance of God. Does that make sense? Right? So this phrase wouldn't be something that like describes God in his essence, but just something that is kind of praising God, glorifying God. And now here, the specifics of it are going to be that you say Allahu Akbar in this opening thing that's called a tahrima, right? And for those who aren't here, like a lot of you have probably heard the word haram before. It means strictly prohibited. So those letters are still in this word, right? Tahrima, haram. You can hear like the letters in both that are similar. So the idea with this is that when you're entering into prayer, you're now rendering for that portion of time things that are normally permissible, they're going to be impermissible for some period of time, right? Like you're not going to be talking to your friend while you're praying. You're not going to pick up the phone while you're praying. You're not eating a sandwich when you're praying. You know, I used the example last week where a friend of mine who used to live with me before I got married, it was like the time of our sunset prayer. And I said, hey, we got to pray. And he was watching the NBA finals. And if you've been to my apartment before, which some of you have, like their TV faces the direction kind of Mecca. And so he said, okay, let's pray. And he just muted the television, but the game was still going on. And I was like, hey man, like that's not gonna work. And he was like, no, it's fine. I'm not gonna watch it. And I'm like, no, like what do you mean? It's literally a flat screen right in front of us. How would you not watch it? The challenge isn't one of anything judgmental. But it can't have like simultaneous actions happening in the course of the prayer. You can't be like watching TV while you're praying the ritual prayer. You know, just like you wouldn't be like walking or doing different actions simultaneously, right? So the tahrima is putting you in that state, that in that moment, it's not that it's religiously impermissible to talk, but in the course of the prayer, you're not going to be speaking to someone. Does that make sense? So transitioning from here to here, the specifics of it are that you are going to start entering the prayer with this phrase right at the onset. Allahu Akbar, that God is greater. God is the greatest. Does that make sense? And you want to think about it from the standpoint of mindfulness, right? They're not just words that are being uttered, but it's giving an affirmation, right? God is greater than that anxiety that I feel. God is greater than the argument that I have. God is greater than the boss who won't let me pray this prayer, right? You're in this space where you are now affirming that I am here standing in front of my creator. Islam is a very pure monotheism. You don't need somebody who is quote unquote religious to lead you in prayer. You don't need somebody else to like supplicate to God for you. Your prayer is heard across the board. There's not somebody who can sanctify for you. There's not somebody who is more elevated than you. Like, your voice is as important. And in this, you're affirming that whatever it is that I'm stepping away from, God is greater than this, right? And I'm literally at a moment now of replenishment inwardly, that this is meant to be a spiritual exercise that is helping me to connect to the divine and allowing for me to see it as a means to something, not as an end. Does that make sense? Right? So that initial Allahu Akbar, it's giving that affirmation. The second necessary act is the recitation of the first chapter, which is called Al-Fatiha, meaning the opening. And if you missed like the 3 or 4 weeks that we went through each verse, I would recommend listening to the podcast, listening to it on YouTube, or just shoot me an email and we can kind of talk it out. Because there's a lot of depth that's in this chapter, and there's a reason as to why it's something that is supposed to be recited in every cycle of prayer again and again, that you can pull so much from it. Do you know? And translations are important. You don't want to knock translations. I was talking to somebody just earlier today who is interested in becoming Muslim. And he saw 2 translations of the Quran on my desk. And he said, do you think there's a limitation to me just engaging the translation? I said, no. Like, when you think about where Islam started, it starts in a Meccan Arabia, and it now extends. And the communities that are in existence at that time are not all Arabic-speaking communities. There's Byzantines and Persians and Romans and huge empires in Abyssinia, what is Ethiopia, and so many other places where people don't speak Arabic. And when people are going to exchange ideas and have conversations, and they're talking about this new religion that exists now in Mecca, they're talking through translation. They're engaging in translation, where you can find meaning through knowing primary language. Nobody can say that that's not something that's advantageous, but it doesn't mean that where you're at is some place that is somehow not also where you're supposed to be. Like, you're working towards something. Do you get what I mean? So you want to build that relationship with it, and not just the translation, but the meaning. And that is going to be something that's a necessary act, right? Which is where we were telling people that you want to start to memorize it and have it be one of the first things that you're adding now to this part of the prayer. This is going to happen in the standing position. So in that standing, you're going to recite this, and it's going to be recited as a necessary act. Does that make sense? Does anybody have any questions on that? What I would suggest, if you haven't started to memorize it already, just like week by week, you are spending time like learning each verse, you listen to it online, and you just go at a pace that makes sense for you. Because this is happening as you are learning this in a reasonable amount of time, you know? And reasonable is very subjective, but if you have the capacity to kind of recognize your ability to just absorb and take in words, we could probably right now, for example, I don't know how old any of you are. I'm 40 years old now at this point in my life, and I know my white beard probably tells a little bit about that, mashallah. But like, you know, Khalid and I have some whites in our hair, and I'm pretty sure like we could put on something that we listened to in the 90s, right, or in the 80s, that we haven't listened to for decades, and it would just flow from us like we were hearing it yesterday, you know? That's the capacity you're built with, right? You can take in things, and they will just like come in some capacity out because they're stored within you in a place that you're not necessarily paying attention to. So if you just go word by word or verse by verse, and be at a place where you're patient. The advantage of this not being here is that you don't have to start with an anxiety that says this doesn't count unless this is happening. Do you get what I mean? And it allows for you to now have a pursuit that says like, hey, you know what? There's not a time frame on this that says I have to learn this by tomorrow. So I can go at a pace that works for me. But I also still have to recognize the pace that I can go at. Do you know what I mean? So if every day you're just learning one of the words to the verse, then in a couple of weeks, you would have the whole thing under your belt. Does that make sense? So this first chapter is important, and it's in the necessary acts. That's why we started with this, so that we could have that relationship with it. Does anybody have any questions on this piece? Does it make sense? Yeah. And building off of this, you're going to recite one long verse or three short verses. From any part of the Quran. And that's why we're going to look at those two chapters in the coming week. One is called Kawthar, which in Arabic, it means essentially like a multitude of like blessings, right? Like if you have any familiarity with Arabic as a language, words are built off of like kind of patterns with root letters. Does that make sense? Is that like a good description? No, it's not. I can tell from your faces. Great. Like in Arabic, if you have the word for prostration is sajda in Arabic, and the place of prostration is called masjid, right? It's got the same letters, right? A book in Arabic is kitab, and the word for office in Arabic is maktab, and the word for library is maktaba, right? It's got the same letters. You see what I mean? Right? So things follow patterns, and you just stick the letters in the patterns, and they'll denote like a meaning. And so the word kawthar, for example, like the word for like a lot of stars in Arabic is kawkab, right? Like we were just in Northern California, my family and I, and my kids, like we've taken them to different places before, but if you've ever been in the mountains of Northern California or parts of like Reno, Nevada at night, it's just like an open sky filled with like beautiful array of stars. It's amazing to see. It's very replenishing, right? To go out into these places in Islam is very much so like a religion that's based off of kind of having this elemental relationship with the world around you. You know, we make are kind of washing up for prayers with water. You know, our prayers ourselves are based off of like a cyclical pattern of the sun. It's telling you to look at the natural world around you. So when there's like all of these stars surrounding us, that would be described as Kaukab, right? Just like thousands of stars all around you. The word Kauthar, like you can hear how it has the same kind of pronunciation as Kaukab, Kauthar. So Kauthar isn't just blessing, but it's like tons of blessings, you know? That chapter is a chapter that like most Muslims memorize because it's super short, right? And there's a ton of people who they just read that in the prayer. It's got a lot of deep meaning to it. The other chapter we're going to look at is called Ikhlas, which is sincerity. And it talks a lot about like who God is in Islam. And next week we'll do a deep dive into that. And that's one of the also necessary components, is that you're learning and you're reciting either one long verse or three short verses. These two things, they're done in the first two cycles of each obligatory prayer. And in every cycle of a voluntary prayer. So if we just take a pause at these three steps, do you see how this is a lot more than just this? Right? Yes or no? Yeah. And can you imagine if this is what you were expected to do right from the minute like you become Muslim, it's obligatory upon you to say your prayers. So if somebody had to do even a portion of these things, or we're teaching somebody, okay, now you got to do this, 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 and this, and this, right? Then they're like, how? Like, how do I do this? Do you know what I mean? And all kinds of things that you'll see people trying to figure out that create like more stress. Whereas like this is supposed to be a replenishing act, not an act that creates distress, you see? So this is like the next necessary act. Any questions on this? Yes, no?
No.
Okay. Then the next necessary act is to prostrate. With most of the forehead and the hard part of the nose touching the ground. So your nose has two parts to it, right? This thing right here, right? I got a big nose, so it's easy to kind of like look around. You can see, like, this is the soft part of your nose, right? And this part is the hard part of your nose. So when you're prostrating, like, this part of your nose should also ideally be touching the ground. Why are these mechanics important in Islam, right? What do you think? What I want you to do, just because now we're getting into things that have mechanical elements to them, you want to build an understanding of, like, why? Like, why is this something that has like this much kind of detail to it? If you can turn to the person next to you, if you don't know their names already, just exchange names. You want to start to think, right? The Quran is a text and invites on every page its reader to not mute their intellectual capacity, but to utilize their intellectual capacity, right? To be aware, to reflect, to contemplate. So why are these things like things that actually play a role to have some element of kind of spiritual upliftment? And they're not just like a checkbox to be able to kind of assess, am I good at this or not? Do you get what I mean? Like, why would it be defined in this much detail?
if you can turn to the persons next to you and just talk it out for a couple of minutes, like what comes to mind, and then we'll come back and discuss. But go ahead. Okay, so what are some of the things we're coming up with? Like, why would this get to these details? And why are they important to think about? What did you discuss? Do you want to say something? You don't want to say something? Why don't you tell us what you talked about?
I actually always use my forehead. I was never told about the nose. And I was thinking, since I believe that when you recite surahs, you have to mouth them, even though we're not saying out loud. So I was thinking we're using our whole face, but our mouthing is already using the surahs. That's where we're using the rest of the face.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, amazing. What else? And not just like limited to the prostration, but all the mechanics, right? Yeah, go ahead.
We were sharing that I said that it's best practice. Hasif mentioned something about like humility and like how you present yourself in front of God.
Okay, and like what does that mean?
Like, it's like how we sit on the ground compared to sitting in pews. It's like the closest you are to Allah when you're on at ground level. So it's like when you're prostrating, it's like you're in sajda, like that's the closest you come to engaging with Allah. Like you're at the most humblest point.
Yeah, amazing. And what do you mean by best practice?
Like, it's like at work, we oftentimes recommend to people like how to best do something. Granted, they don't have to do it, but then somewhere down the line they email us telling us this doesn't work. It's kind of like that. It's like, if you ask me how do you get the maximum prostrating results that you can get, like your face being, like your vision being blocked, your face in that position, that is how you do it. Not, you know, still being able to kind of look out of your periphery or stuff. Like something like that. Like,
that makes sense.
Just thinking on a more technical
What is level. Like the yield supposed to be yeah. as at the end of this? Like, what's the impact, like theoretically, through all this supposed to be?
Worship.
Yeah, but to in order to achieve what?
Like a God consciousness, like a taqwa.
Yeah, right. So something that's internal, right? The external is meant to have an impact, and it's a spiritual exercise. What else? Anybody else? What did you discuss? Yeah.
So maybe it's like a formulaic approach to prevent bid'ah and for people to kind of like not deviate from the structure of the salah.
Yeah, and so the word bid'ah in Arabic means innovation, right? So you're not adding new things and these kinds of things. But think about any exercise that you have, do you know? And what the impact is and how you relate to it individually. If you've never, for example, like run before. I used to run track. I played football. I was supposed to play in college. You can tell because I'm this massive, huge person. I'm sure, you know, that's what you thought as soon as you saw me. And I got injured in my senior year of high school, so I didn't end up playing in college and recruiting stopped. I had multiple concussions. And I did that for a while. I had a trainer and, you know, all these kinds of things. And I have two children. My daughter's 10. My son is 7. They're amazing. I love them both. And I remember seeing my daughter run like once some years ago, and I turned to my wife and I was like, she runs so weird, you know? Like when she runs, it looks so crazy when she runs. And my wife said, stop talking about your child, right? But it's not just about like what you look like, but what it's actually doing to your body. If we went to a physical therapist, you know, and you just show them how you step and where and how our walking isn't done properly, and then the unnecessary pressure it's creating, or like the challenges to your posture and how you do that repetitively again and again and again, it's like a slow yield on really messing up kind of your physical being. Do you get what I mean? Right? Or you go to a doctor and you go to the dentist. I don't know how many of you go to the dentist. I particularly don't go to the dentist as much as I should. and where and how you can talk to the dentist. And the dentist will say, like, if you don't start doing these things, you will not have teeth in your mouth when you are older, right? It's a prescription that necessitates understanding a connection to a regimen that then yields something that if you deter from it, like, that's fine, but it's going to have consequential impact. It's a spiritual exercise. It's going to have mechanics. They're meant to, like, go into a place. Does it mean you would get nothing from it? No. If I run ugly up a mountain, I still ran ugly up a mountain, and I probably build up endurance and lung capacity, but it's not getting to the maximum of what I could yield if I was doing it formulaically correctly. Do you know? If I had never, like, exercised before, right? If any of you have tried to lift weights, the first part to it, you're not going to lift as much as you automatically could because you're getting used to, like, the balance of something, right? And doing something you've never done before. And when you do it for, like, a month or a year, you're that much more kind of innate in the practice. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? So these mechanics are outlined as a best practice that allows for us to be able to recognize that in Islam, like, God is telling you the best way to engage in building a connection to Him. And all of these things go in a sense of twofold. One, there's an ideal that you want to get to, which is that end form. And working your way to it is going to be a process. And two, that end result is going to be what is not, like, outwardly the goal, but inwardly will yield the maximum potential as a spiritual exercise for the deepest connection to God. Do you see what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Right? So as we start to go through some of these things, does it make a difference? It makes a difference in terms of just, like, the intentionality behind it. And recognizing that I'm not the one that is determining the best way to do this. Like, this is being outlined for me, and I want to have particulars with it. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? But just as you're starting out again, it's a little bit more simple than that. Do you know? Because you're getting used to things. If you've never, like, prostrated your head to the ground, you got to get used to it, right? If you've ever been here when somebody takes their shahada or they convert after Jummah, and I'm usually sitting just on my knees because I've been sitting like that for a long period of time, right? People come and they try to, like, mimic it, and then their legs fall asleep and they can't move, and then when they try to stand up, they, like, fall over because they've never, like, sat like that before. Do you know? And I'll say to them, you don't have to sit like this. Like, it's not something that's a part of this thing. You can sit in a chair. You could do this or that, but it's something that there's a wisdom to it being a gradual progression, because you have to get accustomed to even being in those positions if you've never done it before, right? Who bows on a daily basis? Do you know? And so just getting used to the posture, do you see what I mean? Right? Who puts their forehead on the ground on a daily basis? Right? And just getting accustomed to it and then working your way to a place where it becomes more precise. Does that make sense? So here, this is now a necessary component that you are prostrating in that way. Can I erase this? Yeah?
Okay.
You're going to have then the performance of a second prostration before moving on to other parts of the prayer. So when I'm praying, right, I'm going to be in the standing position, I'm reciting those verses from the Quran, I'm going down into a bowing position, and what we said was, like, standing if we were to give a definition to it, is that you're standing straight enough that your arms couldn't touch your knees, right? That's like the standing position. And the bowing is that you are bent enough so that you could touch your knees, right? You want to be in a place where, as much as it is, it's creating this kind of like 90 degree angle. And from the bowing, you're back in a standing position. And then from here, you're going into a prostration, and you're gonna do that twice in every cycle of the prayer when you're going down. Does that make sense? Right? As opposed to doing it just at a minimum one time. Do you get what I mean? Yeah? Okay. Then this one is gonna be really important because it's easy to get away from it. You want to be still in every integral of the prayer. Yeah.
Does that include when you have to like scratch or something?
What do you mean?
Like doing it itchy.
Yeah, if you have like an itch, you know, you could scratch it, right? But as you're building this as a spiritual exercise, what people will say is like, where your heart now starts to be present in prayer, it starts to become like what is kind of overseeing the rest of your being. Do you know? So it doesn't mean you become like devoid of your surrounding necessarily. Like when you're taught to lead the prayer, for example, right, you have to be able to hear what's going on around you, because if you make a mistake in the recitation, somebody behind you is going to correct you. You can't hear them correct you if you can't like hear what's going on around you, right? You're not in this like Jedi Knight moment where all of your senses are suddenly just zeroed in to like what's right ahead of you. Or when you're taught to lead the prayer, you're taught, for example, to listen. Like if a baby cries, you know, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he would shorten like the recitation of the prayer because you don't want to cause difficulty to the parent. You know, if you're in a place where you have like kids in your life, right? And you hear them crying in whatever capacity. Like, do you get what I mean? Right? So you want to limit movements unnecessarily in the course of your prayer, right? But stillness is both in terms of like your actual form in it, as well as like when you're reaching like certain postures in the prayer, right? So I don't want to like go up and then down and up and down and up and down without any kind of like rest in it, you know? Because then it's just like not separate motions, but just one like big movement altogether, right? And each of these is meant to be its own posture. This becomes really hard for people, you know, right? Like there's social experiments that are done where individuals are put in a place of isolation and they're given like nothing other than there's a button in the middle of the room. And they're told, if you push the button, it's going to shock you, you know? And then they're just left to their own devices in the room. And statistically, like most people push the button, right? More men push it a higher number of times than women. And you'll have some that push it just like a little bit, a couple of times, a handful of times. And then there's some people who are like pushing it 100 times, right? And you're like, why would you do that? Because people don't know how to be with themselves. Do you know what I mean? There's like this constant need of having to exert a relationship of something outward. I don't know how to be still, right? In modernity, there's so much that is amazing. You know, we can literally land on Mars. We're in a place where you can understand things at a subatomic level. We could right now live stream this to people all over the world. I get emails from people after who aren't here in person. I'm listening to this from this part of the country. I'm listening to this from here. I'm on your podcast here or there, right? Which is great. Modernity also has certain gaps, and one of the biggest gaps in the prism of modernity is the diminishing of places of stillness. Like people don't know how to rest, do you know? And they don't know how to find rest. And that's why this is an amazing pedagogy on teaching, because the idea isn't to create anxiety through prayer, it's to create stillness through prayer. And you want to find stillness in each of these postures, right? You want to be in a place where you don't kind of deny yourself,
But allow for yourself to take breaths in the course of your prayer, right? Let that be something that releases like stress and allows for you to have that much more focus. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yes.
The next is going to be the first sitting in a prayer. So here we have as an obligation a final sitting, right? But this is going to be a first sitting. Prayers take place in units, cycles. In Arabic it's called rak'ah. And you're going to have like 2 cycles of prayer, 3 cycles of prayer, 4 cycles of prayer. In anything that's more than 2, there is going to be 2 sittings. If you have 2 cycles of prayer, the sittings are just going to be like 1 in the sense of you're in that kneeling position as like a culmination to the prayer. Does that make sense? So that first sitting is one of the necessary acts in the course of the prayer as well. Then there's a part to this that after we do those 2 chapters that you're going to learn to recite in the first cycle of prayer, there's something that's called the teshahud. And this is something that you're going to recite in each sitting of the prayer. So in a 2-cycle prayer, you do this once. And in a 3-cycle prayer and 4-cycle prayer, you're going to do it twice, right? The first part of it is replicating a conversation that takes place between the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and God over the course of a really vividly described like moment where the Prophet is taken from his home to the city of Jerusalem. There he prays with every prophet in a act of just kind of overall religious kind of bond and unity. And from Jerusalem, he's taken into the heavens, meets like a different prophet at every level of heaven, and ultimately at the kind of end culmination of it, engages in a direct conversation with God. And in the course of that, you have the first part of the teshahud, which is a conversation with the prophet and God, where he's essentially like starting saying like greetings and well-being is like for God, and all things that are good and prayers. And the prophet is then given a response that there's like a greeting of peace descended to him. And then he responds again that that greeting of peace is upon all of us, as well as like those who are the righteous servants of God, right? But customary in the prophet, and we'll go into it more deeper and explain each word, but it's like a characteristic that whenever the prophet is given an opportunity for a unique blessing or privilege, he's constantly asking for things for like all of humanity, for all people, like intercession, you know, paradise, heaven, etc. And then embedded in this is that you say like the Shahada in some capacity. And that's where you might see people like raising their finger and this kind of stuff. But this is something that's a necessary act in each sitting of the prayer. Then you're going to say salam at the end of the prayer. So in the obligations, that's not like an obligatory act, right? What you would do here is just like end the prayer. You do an act that one could easily discern is outside of the course of the prayer. You know, you like reach for your coffee, you like do this, you do that. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And then if you're leading in prayer, right, the one leading the prayer recites out loud in the first two cycles of an obligatory prayer. So the first prayer of the day is at sunrise, and the fourth prayer is at sunset, and the fifth is at night. And if you pray in congregation, the person leading the prayer is going to recite out loud in those first two cycles, the first chapter, Surah Fatiha, and the portion of the Quran that they're reading. In the two middle prayers, like the one that's at noon and in the mid-afternoon, it's not recited out loud. And when you're reading alone, in the other prayers, or if you're leading alone, you read silently. And silently means, like, where if somebody was standing next to me, like, that person might be able to hear what I'm saying, but, like, someone on the other side of the room couldn't hear what I was reciting. Does that make sense? Okay. There's two other parts that fit to this that are related to the Eid prayer, as well as, like, another prayer is called the Witr prayer that we'll talk about another day. We're gonna take like a quick pause here, but what I'd love for you to do is just talk about what you're taking away from this, any kind of questions that come up, and then I'll be right back and we'll wrap up with a couple of other things. Yeah? Okay. So where are people at? Where did you take from this so far? What were you talking about in your kind of groups and conversations? Yeah.
I was nice enough to talk to Hector that, I was sharing that being born into Islam, I'm happy that you're breaking this down, because as a kid, you only know, like what I was saying, the extreme right, which is the sunnah. So as growing up, if you don't do it like the sunnah, sometimes people start pointing at you, like, hey, you missed this, or you missed that, or that wasn't correct, or like, oh, it's not, you know, the whole prayer is like not valid anymore. But I was telling Hector that I'm happy that you kind of broke it down like this, because it makes me feel better, because maybe as a kid, like I was technically doing everything right on the left, right? Like on a technical basis. And even people in my family who didn't know how to read all the surahs or knew how to do it, that people would have criticized, they were technically doing it correct. So I was just saying that I'm happy that I'm learning it, how you're learning it, even though I was born into Islam, that makes me feel better.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Any other things that come up for people, thoughts, reflections on things? Yeah. Great. So what you want to start to do is, as you're exploring it, again, like, think out this part and recognize, like, whatever part of the journey that you're in is not something that requires you to know everything before you become Muslim, right? And where and how you might be building a relationship again if you were born into Islam, and being able to recognize that there's different modes through which we can engage some of this, that it still creates like an ease. And we're working our way towards like an end product. And we want to start to build a relationship with some of those necessary parts. So you're going to like memorize the first chapter of the Quran, Surah Fatiha, and then some of those smaller chapters that we talked about, and kind of plunge into it a little bit. So a couple of other things. I know we're kind of at a time that we normally stop. If anybody has to leave, feel free. But just to go through a couple of things really quickly, we're going to resume kind of looking at the alphabet again, which we had done like some weeks ago and went through the first handful of letters. I'm going to
bring those whiteboards that Kiara brought for everybody, and we'll pass those out so that you can start to practice that in real time. And next week, we'll start to look at the recommended acts, which is that last bucket, and we'll look at those two chapters, the two shorter ones, so we can start to build a relationship with some of those things. I know there's some people who weren't here like months ago when we talked about like a similar breakdown to how to wash up for prayer, and what are the kind of obligatory aspects and the necessary aspects and these kinds of things. So why are these things important, for example? Well, there's other situations beyond just learning how to pray that you want to know what are the necessary components and the obligatory components, because you might have to, in a situation, do something that's not like the norm, right? So right now, for example, is the window of time for the fourth prayer, the third prayer of the day, the Asr prayer, which is the mid-afternoon prayer, right? The next prayer of the day doesn't start for a little less than an hour. So you still have some time. Do you know what I mean? But like these prayers have windows of time. So say, for example, you woke up tomorrow morning and you're Muslim and you're supposed to be praying. And the first prayer of the day, the Fajr prayer, it goes right now from like 4 a.m.-ish till about 5:45 in the morning. And you wake up tomorrow at 5:40 in the morning. You get what I mean? You have 5 minutes to wash up and pray the prayer. Does that make sense? So situationally, like when you're washing up for prayer, you might only do the obligatory parts to it, and you might have to just do what's the bare minimum so that you actually pray within the course of the window of time. Do you get what I mean? And you can adapt to it, right? It's not like the ideal, but that circumstance might come up. Do you get what I'm saying? Right? Or situationally, for example, you're at the workplace and you have to figure out, how am I Muslim in a place that Islam is not the norm? Like, what do I do in these situations that's different from when I'm in the comfort of my own apartment? Or if my family is not Muslim and they don't know that I'm Muslim, like, how do I kind of manage some of these things still that require me to be able to still get done what I need to get done, but in a place situationally where I know how to adapt and apply it, that other people might not understand the nuance of that, right? And the generalization I'm comfortable making is like, sometimes people who are born into it, they don't get what it's like to actually convert into it. And they don't know how to kind of give it to us in a way that allows for us to think about this like situationally. Do you know? And see where there's like flexibility and see where there's malleability. Do you get what I mean? It doesn't mean that everybody who is kind of giving us instruction is in a place where they're doing it maliciously, but people are only going to give to you what you possess, what they possess in the first place. And they're going to think about it in this way. I want you to be able to relate to this, whether you are Muslim or not, in a way that allows for you to think this out situationally, so it doesn't create anxiety. But you can be like, oh man, I just woke up and there's 5 minutes left to pray. You know, I was stuck in that meeting and I didn't know how to tell my boss that I gotta leave. Or I was taking this exam and I lost track of time and there's like 3 minutes to get this thing done. Do you get what I'm saying? Right? The ability to adapt. I'll give you a better example. Like when you wash up for prayer, there's a chapter in the Quran that has a verse that is the basis for the washing up. And it mentions everything in the washing up of the prayer, your body parts, other than the mouth and the nose. So you're gonna wash like your face. You're gonna wash your arms up to the elbows. You're gonna wipe over your head. You're gonna wash your feet up to the ankles. Your hands get washed in the course of this as well. The verse doesn't mention the number of times you wash something. The order in which it's washed is not an obligation. Do you know? These kinds of things, as well as the rinsing of the mouth and your nose. Why do you wanna know these things situationally, right? I had some students who called me as the sun was setting and that window of time, the fourth prayer time, is coming to a close. This is in the winter, and they're sledding in Central Park, and they're like, what do we do? Like, we have to wash up for prayer. Can we use the snow? And the answer is like, yes, you can use snow. There are different types of water you can wash up with, and clean snow. Not like yellow snow, but white snow you can wash up with. And they have to be able to know in that circumstance, like how to make wudu, to wash up with snow. And if somebody tells you, you have to, obligatory, rinse out your mouth and your nostrils, what are these guys gonna do? Like shove snow up their nose, right? But how would you know the difference if what somebody told you is not something that you can adapt situationally? It's just the end result. And at the end of it, you're like shoving snow in your socks and you're gargling snow. Do you get what I'm saying? Right? Does that make sense? So we want to learn it in these ways methodically so that you can then learn how to adapt in the course of it. Right? And that's what I'm saying. Let me know if you miss some of those things. We could go through it. You know, like if you wear a headscarf and you have to wash up for prayer. Right? The minimum that you have to wash in some opinions is just a fourth of your head. In some opinions, it's just like any part of your hair. So if I'm already kind of like wrapped up and I'm in this like non-Muslim environment that isn't conducive to this and I'm washing up in the bathroom, like I don't have to take everything off. I could just like stick my head under my scarf. So it doesn't create more anxieties. Do you know what I mean? It might not have to do anything with washing up for prayer, but it's just like, it took me so long to put this on to begin with. Now I have to kind of unravel it and do it. Do you get what I'm saying? Right? And so we want to learn it in this way so that you're able to then think out in scenarios, something that allows for it to be easily adapted to. You're going to say something?
Yeah. Thank you. I just had a quick technical question.
Yeah.
You've been talking about the window of prayer. I cut my prayers pretty close to keep one wudu. Now, for a hypothetical situation, like say, I know this is not Maghrib time, but say Maghrib is at 8:30. Do I have to finish the entire Asr prayer before the Azan for Maghrib?
To finish the prayer before the time of the next prayer comes.
Or can I be in Asr prayer and then the Azan is going off?
No, you finish the prayer, but you want to pray the prayer in its entirety before the next prayer's window starts. Does that make sense?
No.
Like, if you started to pray Asr...
Yeah, 1 minute to go before Maghrib.
Yeah, you want to finish it before Maghrib starts.
But that Asr prayer is valid, even though...
Yeah, if you pray it during Maghrib time, then you're praying it late. Like, the entirety of it should be prayed prior to the next prayer window coming in. Does that make sense?
A little bit.
That's why, like, it's like you're doing what's the minimum parts to it, so it gets done. Do you know? So if you stand to pray, and there's, like, 2 minutes to pray, and in the first standing, like, you decide to recite the longest chapter of the Quran, then, you know, you're not understanding, like, the technical aspects to it. Do you know what I mean? So the performance of the prayer in its window of time is something that kind of trumps like the longevity of a cycle of prayer. Do you get what I mean? Like the praying in its window of time is really important. So let's take a pause here and we'll pick up next Wednesday. And we'll see everybody then. Thank you.